Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Kitty Mortone, Healthy Gut Girl, and I am back from the land of the dead. I actually am not in your large intestine today. I am in my house, and I am still recovering from this weird cough that I've had for over 10 days. And I know almost everyone knows what I'm talking about. But I have never had such a thing in my entire life. Maybe when I lived in New Mexico and I was like allergic to absolutely everything when I was a kid. But it's like a dry cough. It came out of nowhere. I had zero symptoms except for the cough. Maybe a tiny little sore throat, but it was so mild it wasn't even my concern at the time. And then, yeah, turned into this weird dry cough. So basically, I slept on the sofa a bunch because I didn't want to keep my husband awake at night coughing. Super frustrating. I mean, I have so many remedies for cough and sore throat, from herbal natural remedies, supplements, teas, everything, to the big guns, you know, like Theraflu and all those naughty things. And nothing helped. Not one single thing. And so that's just really weird. Anyway, you can still hear that my vocal cords are slightly strained, which is such a bummer. I was like, this is how it goes. This is how I go. I go from talking too much. These are my last days, just like my mother warned me that one day I would just die from talking too much. And I was sure it was over. But guess what, Mom? I'm still here. Ha ha. Anyway, I was so excited to have this guest on. He is someone that I met in the estrogen dominant support group. And he came about because of the pro-metabolic community and because of the repeat community. And he joined the group. And he's so clever, really funny, and has great input and contributes amazing things to the group. And our friend Diego was like, you have to have him on the show. I might have to have Diego on the show. And so I did. And so he's here. And he talks about something extra special, close to my heart, because I share with so many of you out there, I have a traumatic brain injury. And he talks about that. He also talks about a bunch of, you know, metabolism, movement, breathing, isometric training, bone health. He really goes there. And this was full of surprises for me. I learned so much. So everyone, listen up and welcome Brian Thomas.
Well, and then so how did you get caught up in the pro-metabolic world at all? Like before that, you were, what were you up to?
Yeah, so I actually, before I got into pro-metabolic stuff, I was like a lot of people going from one diet lily pad to another. And I was paleo, and then I was, well, that's not working, so I'm going to go paleo and intermittent fast. And then that stopped working, so I said, okay, well, I'm going to do paleo, intermittent fasting, and keto. And eventually got to the point where I just continually felt worse and worse and worse. And I was at a course that I was taking on brain stuff. And one of the people at that course had invited me to hang out with him to study outside of the course. And I was all in on the brain stuff. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, all right, well, we have to go to the grocery store to get some food because this stuff is really taxing to me fuel-wise. I said, okay, that's fine. We can go to the grocery store. Everyone goes to the grocery store. I didn't grasp the magnitude of the importance of fuel for the nervous system at that point. But when we go to the store, he's grabbing Coke, he's grabbing orange juice, he's grabbing milk, and I'm still keto. So I'm thinking, well, I can't have any of this stuff. Like, this guy's crazy. And so we get there, we grab all that stuff. I'm like, I'm going to be polite. I'll indulge with all this. And when I get back home, I'm going to go right back into ketosis because that's the way. That is the only way that I'll ever obtain health. So we're sitting there in the sun in Arizona. We're drinking Coke and orange juice, just soaking up sunlight, getting all this sugar, and I felt great. I said, wow, I don't feel like I'm dying like I thought I would. But I went home that night, or I should say I went to the hotel that night, fell asleep, slept better than I'd slept in years.
Oh, wow.
And then when I woke up, I was completely recharged. I was focused. I was rested. I said, okay, this isn't normal for me. This is different. Tell me more about this Ray Peet guy. Tell me more about some of these ideas because this is better than I have felt in a very long time, doing the exact opposite of what every expert I'm following is telling me to do. And then after that, I was all in.
Wow. So you were properly going into ketosis. So you were testing, you were like hardcore.
I was hardcore, and I tend to overdo things. I've been called the consummate overachiever. So it's one of those things that I didn't take lightly. I said, no, I'm going to bath and I'm going to make sure that I'm there. I'm going to do the cold thermogenesis. I'm going to do this all in because it's the way to do it. So I did, and I just kept getting worse.
And what kind of things were you suffering from that made you even look at keto and all these other diets?
So initially, I stumbled into paleo because I was struggling with my weight a little bit. I wasn't happy with where I was. And I started dating a woman who became my wife later on. And at
Congratulations.
the time, thank you. At the time, she was gluten-free. And I was coming from a perspective that, oh, gluten's nonsense. That doesn't matter. You don't need to be gluten-free. That's just a made-up bad thing. I saw firsthand what would happen to her if she ate gluten. She would get headaches, very lethargic, falling asleep very easily, pain behind the eyes. I said, okay, that's a noticeable difference when you have that might be a real thing. And I said, well, I like this gal. I'm going to hang out with her more often. So I'm going to go gluten-free too, because this is going to be easier for the both of us, which turned into, well, then I'm going to do grain-free. This is that overachiever coming through. I said, I'm going to go grain free, and you better yet, I'm going to go paleo because it's gluten free by default. So I did that because that was the logical step for me to go from a normal to extreme diet because that's what you do in any sane situation. So I stumbled into that, and initially I thought, okay, this is going to be the way. This is going to be, it all makes sense. I was reading Mark Sisson, I was reading Rob Wolf stuff. I read book after book after book, and everyone said, this is the way that your ancestors did it. You should do it too. And thinking that I was on the right track because I was reinforcing with what I was reading, I got really good at ignoring how I was feeling. And over time, I started to realize I was very irritable. I was very stressed out all the time. My sleep was suffering. And I actually had a loss of sex drive. I had a loss of libido. And that was worrisome to me because I was in my 20s at the time. A 20-year-old male with a loss of libido, it's kind of a red flag.
And a new wife.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So it was one of those situations where I said, well, I have a problem. Everyone says I'm on the right track. Maybe I need to go further. So I did the fasting piece, and then I did the keto piece. And lo and behold, things just kept getting worse and worse and worse in every arena. So.
So, when you say, so let's just go to the diet parts of like, Coke. Okay. So when Ray P talks about Coca-Cola, he's talking about like the Coca-Cola that used to be just made with sugar, right? Not the Coca-Cola now that has all these different, unwanted things in it. Like I think high fructose corn syrup's in Coca-Cola now, or right? And so that's not really what we want, right? Or is it?
It depends. So my philosophy at this point is pretty much anything that can break a stress state that you don't want can be used beneficially. It might be high fructose corn syrup because that influx of sugar can break that adrenaline cortisol cycle. You can get yourself out of that stress state, shift your metabolism back into a favorable state. And then you can start the healing and repair process again. Now, does that mean I want to live on high fructose corn syrup? Probably not. But it's one of those things where priority number one is getting somebody out of that stress state. If we can keep the metabolism going in the right direction, we have a lot better chance at dealing with all of the environmental stressors we're dealing with in our modern world. Now, I would prefer somebody use sucrose. I would prefer somebody use fruit or orange juice. But if that's not available at that time and all you have is road trip options because you got a gas station, that's the next best bet. It's better than nothing. It's better than going into ketosis or fasting because, oh, I don't have the ideal scenario. Life's not always ideal.
That's so funny because when I first moved to LA, not first, but I guess I had been here for like 5 or 6 years, I think, I joined the famous Gold's Gym. And I hired a nutritionist who was from Austria, randomly. Although he was friends with Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was going to that gym at the time as well. But he would say to me, he was talking like this. He's a bodybuilder, so he's all about, macros. He's all about getting enough protein, getting enough of everything. And so he had made my plan for me, but I was not in the place to really understand it yet, because I didn't have the problems that I have as I got older. I still had a lot of autoimmune stuff, but no one was talking about that yet, right? Like this guy, he was trying to get me strong and have stamina and be fit. And I was one of these people that was skinny all my life. So I was like, I want muscles, but do I really want to work this hard? Like I just didn't have the awareness yet. I didn't associate fitness and counting your macros with how ill I was. Like those were two separate things, right? They were compartmentalized. But he used to say to me, I said, well, sometimes I can't eat. Sometimes I'm really busy and or whatever. And he said, look, if the Snickers bar is all you have in front of you and you've not eaten since whatever, eat the Snickers bar. It's better to have something than nothing. And I was like, what? That sounds stupid. Because Snickers, but by this time, people were already talking about how bad sugar is. I was like, this guy's crazy, And now I look back, I'm like, oh, if I just would have utilized, and I paid that guy, and I didn't get the most out of my, But yeah, if I still had that program, I bet you it would be all about what I'm doing now.
It's not to say that macros don't have their place. I think that they do. I'm skeptical of using macros a lot of times with people as a starting point because I think a lot of times, like you said, it doesn't give people enough bandwidth to actually address the problems they need. Sometimes weight loss isn't the best tool for somebody at that time. You have to
So
kind of
you look at macros as a weight loss tool. You're not looking at it in terms of like, am I getting enough protein? Is it balanced with my fat? And is it balanced with my carbohydrate? Because that's how I'm this, like you said earlier, you said, what did you say? You said, having like a your real an awareness of, oh, this is more. Oh, when your friend gave you the sugar and the Coke and the milk and stuff. And I'm going through that now where I'm like, oh, this isn't about weight loss. That's a byproduct if you've got weight to lose. But right now I'm actually gaining weight on this program that I'm doing with Kitty Bloomfield. And it's like what I'm realizing is that eating carbohydrate out of balance. Like eating, like that's where people go wrong, isn't it? Like you can have a donut, but like what in the context of what you've eaten in your entire day, how does that look? Does that look like 75% of your diet has been carbohydrates and fat and more? Like that's when so that's where I feel like I'm having this renaissance of education in regards to macros and tracking what I'm eating. Is it hard? Yeah. And I can see throwing this at a newbie and people being like, oh no, I'm not, no. Well, that's what happened to me with that guy at Gold's Gym. I was like, this is no, I'm not going to do this for my life.
And it's one of those things, like again, I think it really comes back to where somebody's starting at. Because if somebody's dealing with a major issue in their life, they potentially had some childhood traumas. Maybe they've had some sort of injuries, concussions. They've got some sort of vision issue. They've got some sort of breathing issue. They got something going on neurologically. Their fuel demand might be exceptionally higher than what a typical macro plan might allow for them. And so to actually break free of some of those symptoms and to actually get to that next level, sometimes we have to actually overdo certain things. I think you have to have enough protein. Because without protein, you don't make neurotransmitters. And if you don't make neurotransmitters, then the brain's not going to function well. And if the brain's not functioning well, your entire existence is going to be very different. But if you don't have enough carbohydrates, if you don't have the right kinds of fats and enough of them, then you're not going to make enough hormones. You're not going to, the hormones you do make are going to be geared towards survival and stress responses rather than healing and adaptation. And if you're dealing with any sort of issues neurologically, we need your brain to calm down and adapt to the new you, not to hold on to the old things that happened traumatically. So that changes how you kind of, how I kind of look at food with people, because sometimes depending on the person, they need more directed effort towards a specific issue than what macros can sometimes allow.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's probably something that that coach I mentioned at Gold's was probably not educated on, like, you know, dealing with people with illness. He's getting, you know, me coming in like, oh, I want to, you know, look better in a bathing suit. And I have this funny little tiny belly in the front, but I'm too skinny and I need muscle, you know, or he's getting people coming in saying, I just want to be stronger and I want to bodybuild or whatever. You know, he's not, I'm not, I wasn't going in there saying, listen, I've got a traumatic brain injury. I've got this, I can't break down adrenaline well, which is who I know of myself now. Like, I know these things about myself. So like the Kitty Bloomfield program, it actually takes into consideration all of that stuff that you're dealing with. Like, are you hypothyroid? Are you dealing, are you in menopause? Are you, you know, what kind of traumas are you dealing with? And so, yeah, that's brilliant. I totally, that's, so your background, you're coming from, you're coming at this pro-metabolic world from a real neuroscience perspective, aren't you?
Yeah, my background, I got into the neuro side of things about 10 years ago. And I had been doing training and nutrition now for close to 20 years. But 10 years ago, I started down the neurological route with a organization called Z-Health, the Health Performance Solutions. And they teach people in the health and wellness world, whether you're chiropractors or physical therapists or even trainers, how the nervous system works and how you can actually interact with it to create changes in people's lives. And that opened my entire perspective towards the value of pro-metabolic nutrition. One of the most fascinating concepts that came about in that educational direction was the idea that Bobby Fischer, for example, the chess player. Some of your listeners may not know who that is. You can go back and look him up. But one of the greatest chess players of all time, very eccentric person. But it was a known phenomenon that he would lose 10 to 15 pounds during a chess tournament playing chess. So he's literally sitting there. And that's his exercise program. Pick up the piece, move it to the board, hold his chin. That's his exercise program, but he would lose 10 to 15 pounds in a chess tournament because neurologically, the brain being the most fuel-hungry organ that we have, it's working so hard. So that right there, if you have somebody who's dealing with some weird neurological anomaly or some sort of issue in a sensory deficit or their life is just too neurologically demanding, that can change their fuel resources and their responsiveness to the diet that they have.
Interesting.
So if somebody's dealing with some of those problems and coming from it from a low carb or ketogenic perspective, you may actually run into issues over the long term because now your brain is going to adapt to a lack of fuel, to a lack of glucose in the brain, and that changes how nerves are going to function, changes what brain areas will function, and that can change somebody's entire personality.
Wow. So the you know, they say the brain is mostly fat, and does that mean you have to eat fat? I mean, obviously you have to eat fat, but like, does the fat go into the brain and help it? But, or is it all, is it fat and carbs and protein that help fuel the brain? Or is it just glucose? I'm confused, obviously.
Yeah, no, this is a common question.
Okay, good.
Glucose is the main energy source for the brain.
Okay.
So you can use ketones. If you were in ketosis and you were making ketones, those will still get into the brain. And they can be used, but generally speaking, even in ketosis, you're still going to have backup systems in place to make sure there's still going to be glucose available. You'll never be glucose free.
That's why when you're in ketosis, if you don't have enough fuel, your body will break down tissue, will break down muscle. What else will it break down?
It'll break down muscle, it'll break down organs, it'll break down your thymus gland, it'll break down tissues that are involved with other functions beyond just moving joints. So you have a lot of things that your body is willing to literally destroy and convert it into sugar. That's how important sugar is for your brain.
Wow.
There is a researcher out of Germany, I believe it is. It's either Germany or Austria. His name is Achim Peters. And he posited this idea called the selfish brain theory. And the selfish brain theory states that your brain is constantly trying to crave fuel. And depending on what's happening in the body, your brain can actually create a hormonal environment to make you diabetic in the body to elevate your blood sugar so that it can get to the brain.
Wow.
So oftentimes people will have blood sugar regulation issues, not because of something in their body, and they're going to go work out, work out, work out, work out, but their brain is actually saying, no, I need more fuel. So I'm going to make you diabetic to get it.
Wow. That would explain the whole type 3 diabetes being Alzheimer's, because I guess when the body runs out of that accessible fuel, it's going to end up happening in the brain, right? Or is
Yeah,
that just okay?
exactly. And so when we think in terms of your brain having all of these other functions beyond just the firing of neurons, there's actually cleanup processes involved. Your brain is a endocrine organ itself. It can make hormones. In fact, the entire cascade of cortisol and adrenaline production in the adrenals starts in the hypothalamus of the brain. And so as far as your brain is concerned, any dysregulation of fuel that your brain's going to experience, meaning if there's anything that interrupts how fuel gets to the brain or how your brain uses it, that's going to have a huge cascade of effects well down the road. But in terms of things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, we're seeing this huge amount of interest right now in how dysregulated energy metabolism can influence how your brain can't do all of those key functions. And we're seeing all sorts of side effects along the way, including these neurodegenerative disease states.
Yeah, wow. It's scary. So I'm realizing as we're talking that I don't really understand fully how food. So is it true that everything we eat has to ultimately be broken down into sugar, into fuel, into glucose, glycogen? What is that process? Is that true? Like, okay, people say, well, even if you eat a steak, it still has to be ultimately, it gets broken, bro. Even the proteins, everything gets broken down to its smallest thing, which is the fuel for the body. Is that true?
It is with a caveat.
Okay.
Much of what your body does with that is built, or how I should say, how well your body can break those things down hinges upon the health of all of the systems involved in your digestive tract. So if you're not making enough stomach acid, you might not be able to break down some of that protein well enough. If you don't have enough of the gut barrier or the brush border of the gut, your ability to extract some of those vitamins, minerals, amino acids, sugar from the system, you might actually not be able to absorb stuff. So then from that standpoint, you might actually have an adequate amount of calories, but an inadequate amount of absorption.
Malabsorption. Really common too, right?
Yeah, and that's a big emphasis on why the gut is so important.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have appropriate gut function, lots of things will suffer.
And so what do other things get broken down to? So I mentioned it in my post today. I think you might have commented in it about ultimately, like everything gets like the most usable form of fuel for the body is glucose, and the most usable form of glucose is from things that turn into sugar quite easily, things that like juice, like things that already have sugar in them. But so if that's its preferred form of fuel compared to fat and protein, which, yes, it's fuel. Yes, it's needed for all these different things, but does it get broken down to sugar?
In emergency circumstances, yes,
Okay.
but not in your normal everyday healthy function.
Okay.
So, trying to convert protein into sugar is a much more inefficient process than converting sugar into sugar. because
Got
it's
it.
all so
Right.
you eat fat. And so it's one of those weird arguments that people will often make in the ketogenic world, saying, oh, I don't need carbohydrates. There's not an essential carbohydrate because I'll make enough even if I don't eat it. But that doesn't mean that you're making it in a healthy manner.
Right.
And so the process of actually liberating fat from storage, getting it into the bloodstream, getting it broken down, requires the activity of an enzyme called hormone-sensitive lipase. Hormone-sensitive lipase, or HSL, is sensitive to the hormone, ready for this, drum roll, brrr, cortisol.
Oh.
So in order to utilize and liberate fat from storage to make up for an absence of glucose, you have to have an elevation in cortisol. And so when we think neurologically, now cortisol actually will lower activation in certain key brain areas like your frontal lobe. Your frontal lobe is where you have all of your logic, your reason, all of your human processes. Your ability to go into an online group and not say the wrong thing to somebody that, or not pick the fight with the person, you can say, ah, they really don't know what they're talking about on this. That's your frontal lobe holding you back from going ahead and arguing with everybody. So if you're missing your frontal lobe's activation because you have low blood sugar, it's very easy to get into an argument. And so it's one of those situations where relationships with friends, with family, with loved ones, at the holidays, it's very easy to get into those arguments when you have low blood sugar. So if you want to prevent those unnecessary strains on certain relationships in your life, probably worth making sure you're not dipping into cortisol so much to rely on that as your main driver for fuel.
Wow, that is so interesting. It really goes to the speaks to the whole concept of, people who are high wired and easily upset and easily triggered. I certainly was that most of my life, very dramatic, very emotional, very reactive. And, now that I'm getting, now that I'm older, and using my frontal lobe more, thanks to my pro-metabolic diet, it's like I find myself not so triggered. I find my and I see it in other people. I watch it, just like you said. Like I had that discussion on the phone here earlier with someone, and I can see them reacting emotionally and unhinged. I'm watching them fall apart, and everything that I say is an emotion, it triggers an emotional reaction, and they're not using their frontal lobe to calm down and to just be because they're in a cortisol state. And so I'm like, it's a good thing you're in the group because you need more progesterone. Just kidding.
Yeah, and a lot of people do. It's that was one of the big things that I think Ray did a lot of good work for the world in his research, his compendium of knowledge that he shared selflessly. But one of the biggest things was the power of progesterone. I think another big thing, and the thing that you kind of mentioned, is that, and this is the part I think people miss, and especially if they're coming from other dietary models where it's built on rule. If you're a vegan, you don't eat anything from an animal. If you're a carnivore, you don't eat anything from a plant. If you're keto, you don't eat carbs. If you're paleo, you eat roadkill and pine cones. I don't know. Like, it's basically people come into these nutritional cults with rules to follow. And the pro-metabolic world is nothing like that. And people want to make it about, oh, don't eat this, eat that instead. And that's just a continuation of that same thought process. Ray was very much about your own self-experimentation to figure out what it is that helps you to live the life that you want to live. And so for somebody, it might be you need more B vitamins. For another person, it might not be B vitamins, it might be progesterone. And so giving yourself the respect, the biological respect that you deserve to be able to say, my situation is unique. Everything I've done up to this point is proprietary to me. I may only need certain things where somebody else might need something else. And I may not thrive on the diet somebody else does, while somebody else thrives on that very diet that tears me apart. And that's entirely okay. But if you come into it with the idea that I'm going to change my health, I'm going to change my nutrition, I'm going to improve this metabolic function in my body, you will see those changes in your personality. because now you're actually taking the brakes off of the system to allow your brain and your body to interact with the world in a much more safe and friendly way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting that you would say that, because I would like to know what Dr. Pete would say to people. Like, I don't know if he's ever commented on this. I've certainly listened to a lot of his stuff, but like, what would he say to someone who has been on carnivore, low carb for, 4 years, and they are living the dream? You know, like, would he just say, good for you, great? Or would he be like, something's probably being overlooked here, and I would be very wary about X, Y, or Z? Like, what do you think he'd say?
Well, to be honest, I don't think it'd be fair for me to say what I think he would say, because obviously he's no longer with us, for one. And for two, I think he would probably say something very different than what I would say. If it were me, I would first want to see if they actually want to change anything. Because like you said, if they're cruising on cloud nine, cool, keep going.
Yeah.
That would be something you can tolerate or you can handle, for at least for now.
Yeah.
I would have concerns with it over the long term. I would be very concerned about getting enough calcium. That's one thing I don't hear a lot of carnivore people discuss, is what are we doing for calcium? Because calcium to phosphorus ratio is exceptionally important for bone function. So if you don't have enough calcium over a long enough period of time, you'll pull it from your bones. And that can open the door to osteopenia, osteoporosis, things like that down the road.
Yeah.
That can be problematic. Simultaneously, one of the other things that's really important for bone health is carbon dioxide, of which carnivore diets, because you're relying predominantly on fat for energy, you're going to be making less carbon dioxide. So right there from the onset, they're at several disadvantages for the health and integrity of their bones. And that's just one mineral that they're missing. So there's that issue to be concerned with. I would also be concerned with, again, changes in the brain function, changes in what happens to your brain when you're missing adequate glucose, because your brain will change, your brain will adapt. In people that lose their sight, people that go blind, either born blind or lose their sight later on, that brain real estate gets taken over for other functions. So your brain will always change. Your brain will always shift around resources and activation patterns based on what's available. But when you're restricting certain key macronutrient groups over a long enough period of time, that's going to change your brain. There's no way around that. I don't know what kind of changes will happen over the long term, because that's still a very new concept to look at. But I have a feeling that over the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to see a lot of people, especially in the long-term carnivore community, that if we actually were to look at those things like type 3 diabetes in the brain, we're going to see some very interesting brain scans and some very interesting changes in people's personality.
Wow. So let's go back to the neuroscience part of it, since you touched on that again. What can you speak on traumatic brain injury? Anything in relation to, like, when it comes to the pro-metabolic lifestyle choices? Like, I mean, we kind of already said it, but the whole idea of, the brain needing fuel. So if you have injury, though, like, how do you go about that? Because a lot of people have, including myself, have traumatic brain injury. So I'm curious how you would work with someone in that way.
From a traumatic brain injury standpoint or a concussion standpoint, first thing that I'm going to think about is, A, what kind of damage or trauma was done to the brain? So depending on the impact, depending on the injury, you can actually experience what's called diffuse axonal shearing. You think of nerves connected and then they get jarred really quick. Those nerves can shear. You can lose connections. And so if that's happening, well, now I have to relearn how to do the things that those connections were helping me do. That's a very expensive process, both in the way of I need adequate nutrition and fuel to get my brain to fire and fire and fire until it reestablishes new connections to make up for those. And two, it's expensive from the standpoint of creating activation. One of the things that your brain is going to need in dealing with concussions and rehab for TBIs and trauma like that is you need to create the activation that your brain is missing. So a concussion might happen on the right side of my head. And that's depending on where it happens and depending on the extent of the damage and the state that I was in metabolically at the time and the activation patterns I had at the time and so on and so forth. My concussion and your concussion could be experienced very differently, even if we had the same injury. So it becomes a very individualized process to figure out what do I need? What do I experience in the world? And what do I want to change? And how do I respond to my training, my nutrition, my supplementation? Because again, you and I might go to the gym together. We might do the same workout, and you might feel awesome afterwards, and I might feel like garbage. Because the metabolic cost of that activation pattern might be too high for what I'm dealing with. So some people might not actually be healthy enough yet neurologically to handle certain training programs. And some people do better with things like aerobic exercise versus strength training, or vice versa. And some people do better with yoga versus any of these other two. So a lot of it comes back to giving yourself the permission to be exploratory. Be able to say, I may not fit into this dietary rule. I may not fit into these other simple diet rule protocols. I might have to find my own way. I might have to find my own nutrition. I might have to find my own supplementation. I might have to find my own training and activation program that helps my nervous system heal and restore these connections. So from that standpoint, nutrition can be very individualized because I might not be able to make it 2 hours without eating, at least in a while. If I go to work and I'm under fluorescent lights all day, the heavy blue end of that spectrum might be very demanding for my brain, where somebody else might have outdoor natural light coming in all the time, and they're going to respond very differently. So light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, that can all have a negative or positive impact on the brain, depending on the person.
Interesting. So what about when you have a traumatic brain injury, how does that affect hormones? Because I listened to that Joe Rogan podcast that was one of his more famous ones ages ago about I forget the doctor's name. Mark, I think, is his first name, where he had a football player and like a special forces guy on, and both of them were suicidal at one point, and it was just this incredible, incredible episode on brain trauma and how it can really affect hormone production and how these men were dealing with undetectable levels of all their hormones, basically, and neurotransmitters were bottomed out, and they were basically so depressed that they were about to kill themselves. And then they got on hormones and hormone therapy, and I don't remember them talking much about diet, but we're assuming that these men were somewhat fit since they were athletic and whatever. But why does it affect hormone? I mean, I know because we've got our, pituitary and hypothalamus and in our brain. But is that it? Like, why?
So a big part of hormones, an easy way to think of your hormones, especially reproductive hormones, but hormones in general are indicators to your cell of the current state of your situation. So if I think of it from a reproductive hormone standpoint, one of the things you'll often see, and the name for this is actually the female athlete's triad. But you will actually see, especially in women who are over-exercising, they're overtraining, they're under-eating, they're in a sport that requires them to keep a certain weight. Dancers are notorious for this. You'll see them stop having a menstrual cycle because the body says reproductive health, carrying on the species in your organism right now is not a high priority. Doing as much as we can to keep you alive is. And so when we see brain trauma, when we see all of these things that are now changing how your brain is interacting with the world, because all of a sudden sound and light becomes more stressful. All of a sudden movement becomes a higher cost because your demands of all the systems involved with movement, it's harder for your brain to determine that your movement that you're doing is actually safe. Now your brain is starting to interpret the world as less and less safe. So then you'll see all of these things tank out. You'll see your testosterone reduce, estrogen, progesterone, all of these things will change and reflect how safe your brain thinks you are or not. And so when you have these injuries to the brain, you have these neurological systems trying to rewire, relearn, and they're missing that activation or they're missing that fuel, what you're going to see is your brain saying, priority number one, keep you alive. Priority number two, everything else. So if I can't determine that you're safe right now, this is your brain talking.
Mm-hmm.
Can't determine that you're safe right now. I'm going to shut down all these other functions until we can get enough resources. I'm going to spare resources elsewhere to try and be selfish with them to make sure I have enough to keep you alive.
Wow. So repeatedly getting hit in the head or having, you know, like these football players or having this concussion, their body is on high alert. Their body's like, this is dangerous. My central nervous system is at risk, which is putting my enteric nervous system at risk. I'm basically at risk. And so we're not going to be procreating. We're not going to be having a libido. We're not going to be growing our hair or nails. Everything goes on the back burner. And we're just going to keep your heart beating and your brain, your blood sugar and your brain balanced as much as possible until you kick it.
Absolutely.
Or and until I'm given a better indicator, more indicators that things are okay.
Exactly. And that's the biggest thing for rehabbing TBIs and concussions or any sort of brain improvement is what can I do to improve how my brain perceives my situation? If somebody comes to me and says, I want to be stronger, I say, okay, we're going to bench press because then that's their model of strength. They want to get better at bench pressing. All right, what can you bench right now? All right, that's an output of the brain. Your brain is sending that signal to the muscles. Your brain is moving the barbell. Your brain is determining the amount of tension it wants to create. However, if your brain is more concerned that you're not going to survive the attempt, it will shut down the output to those muscles far beyond what the actual tensile integrity of those tissues can handle. So it will actually stop you well short of your potential strength because it doesn't feel safe when you're under the bar.
Oh my goodness. Because the body's not like, oh, they're just at the gym. Your brain's not like, oh, you're just at the gym. Your body's like, you are putting me under stress. You could be bench pressing, or you could be trying to lift a car off of somebody. Like the brain is just like, I'm under this intense pressure
mm-hmm.
to push this bar, this weight up. That's all the brain's perceiving, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you want to improve your strength or your speed or your stamina or your flexibility, those are all going to involve your nervous system. So if you're not interacting with your nervous system in a way that your nervous system likes, or you're constantly bombarded with things from the environment, from your life, from the lights in your office, to it's just getting stuck in traffic, to almost getting in a car accident, and then you go to the gym and think you're going to perform well, your nervous system's going to hold you back.
This is so good. This is so good because this will segue us into the whole adrenaline talk. So I had this this friend of my husband's who was like this young woman who's a surfer, and she does jujitsu and she's a photographer. She's just this go-getter. And she we were talking about weightlifting, and I said, I really want to get into heavy weights, low reps. And I was watching a lot of Kitty Bloomfield stuff and wasn't quite ready to jump in the deep end with that. And she's like, well, come work out with me. I'm like, okay. So I go with her, and you know, she kept stopping me and saying, you know, we need you to breathe properly here because you are holding your breath a lot. And you're also shallow breathing when you do breathe. She goes, you're sending signals to your brain that you're in a state of emergency here at the gym. And that is not where you want to be because you're right. And this is a girl that is super young and she's not in this world that we're in. And she blew my mind. I literally almost cried because I was like, you just solved my problem of working out. Because she said, you're in this stress state, and then you're creating cortisol, adrenaline, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all these emergency hormones. And she's like, and if your brain thinks it's on high alert, and then you'd lift all this heavy weight and you go home, you are not going to recover from that as well as if you were in a as calm as possible. And that adrenaline won't get broken down, and you're going to start to build up lactic acid and ammonia in the body. You'll be sore for days. And I was like, girl, literally, I was like, praise God. You just basically told me why, explained to me why my workouts are so horrible and I can never recover. And you're just validating that in a more thorough way. Amazing.
It's what I think what you're, and we're already seeing this in the industry, in the fitness side of things, but we're going to see a lot more people talking about neurological function in a workout setting in the very near future. We're going to see a lot more people having the same discussion you just had because we're understanding more now, finally. And the information is spreading. The information is trickling out into some of these avenues. And you're going to see a lot of people drag their feet to come along with it because it's going to confront a lot of what they've been saying for so long. Because it's going to change and it's going to give people the permission to say, this model of fitness of one size fits all, it's not happening anymore.
Yeah.
We don't work that way.
It's also going to make people realize that hit a lot of people, and like you said, some people are fine with it, but that HIIT training and CrossFit and all of these high intensity workouts are the reason that they are having adrenal fatigue and the reason that they are crashing. And, you know, I did CrossFit for 9 months. And I was rowing and I was hearing my heartbeat in my ears, and I would get off and finish the WOD and I would go up to my coach and say, what the time, it was the owner of the gym, because my coach was wonderful, but this owner, and I was like, excuse me, I'm like, I can hear my heartbeat in my ears and I don't think I'm going to faint, but it's just hard and it's weird. And he said, if it was easy, we wouldn't be doing it, would we? He's like, and if it was easy, like he was like, it needs to be hard. It has to be hard. And he was real short with me. And I was like, that doesn't feel right, you know? And then I would like go have breakfast and I had to throw up in the alley one day. And I was like, and I'm like, yeah, I'm doing it, you know? And I'm getting on the wall outside and I'm like jumping and doing the splits in the air. I'm like, yeah, yay me. And after that crash, which took 9 months to happen, I was depressed. That's when I full blown anemia, full blown, like this was where progesterone saved my life. And I actually ended up having to get a blood transfusion. And I blame it all on that process of just ignoring my body, ignoring the signals and being in this. And yeah, my brain not feeling safe. My body just completely over, you know, I would sleep for 2 hours in the middle of the day. It was crazy. And I was eating everything in sight.
Yeah.
I looked great though.
There is something to be said for that, but
yeah,
it's one of those examples. And I see this quite often with people coming from a CrossFit or similar kind of exercise background, but it's one of those examples of that mantra that it has to be hard or it's not worth our time. It's,
yeah,
we refer to it as the work ethic dilemma. If it's not a lot of work, it's not worth it. But when you actually do work with people that are trying to train for Olympian level of performance, most of their time is spent on skill work. They're not doing CrossFit. They're not doing these types of things unless they want to compete at CrossFit.
Yeah.
They're spending time on building skills, developing tissue tolerance, and progressing with technique and focus on improvement.
And rest.
And they're doing it in a very deliberate manner. They're not just going out there to say, I'm going to kill myself in the gym, and then I'm going to do it again tomorrow. If I'm not sweating and covered in sweat, then it wasn't worth my time. Come out here to East Texas. It's 84% humidity today. That'll make you sweat in 5 minutes. That doesn't mean you're getting any better.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think people are going to drag their feet, even though this information is like a little tsunami coming at us. And I think people are going to drag their feet because so much has been invested into, I mean, honestly, my husband and I just joined a new gym, and it's this John Reed gym, which is like all over the world. It's crazy. It's so beautiful. Like if heaven had a gym, it would be this gym. Although my heaven wouldn't need a gym. Okay. But, but, It's beautiful. And it's like we went to opening day and it was like filled with models. You could tell they paid all these guys to take their shirts off and these girls to do handstands and all this stuff. It was crazy. But I knew it wouldn't be like that once all those people left. And it wasn't. Nobody was there the first day we went. It was amazing and beautiful. But my point is that in this area of Santa Monica, in this, I'm going to say a 1 mile radius, there's an Orange Theory, a SoulCycle, an Equinox. There's every Pilates, every type of Pilates, every type of yoga, and then gyms. My other gym is right across the street. My last gym. I mean, it's like an all HIIT training. So people are really going to drag their feet with this because they're going to be like, I love it. I feel so good. And I mean, good. Like you said earlier, like, hey, keep going. You want to change anything in your life? Then let's talk. But yeah, exactly. So I think it's amazing though, but people are overlooking that because they think harder is better. And just to slip this in there, because I don't want people thinking that the Kitty Bloomfield program is like that. So she and I had a discussion before because I wanted to talk to her first because I didn't want to feel like I was going to invest in this program and then end up being like, this isn't for me, you know? It's too much. I'm getting sore, all those things I mentioned earlier. And she was like, no, honey, no. Like, it is a slow process. In the lifting weights, you're taking time to do those deadlifts. They are in your form. You're sending us videos of your form. We want to make sure that you're stacking your wrists when you're doing this. And they're so specific and so slow about it. And you got to be good with that because that's the healthier way to do that, right? So I just wanted to mention that because Kitty's program is not like that at all. It's very much attention to detail, attention to being. It's going to take some time before you see results. So get used to that concept, you know?
And Kitty is on a very short list of people that I would suggest someone look at if they're not familiar with that stuff. She's awesome. She's one of my favorite people. She's one of my favorite Australians, too, for that matter.
I know, me too. That's funny. I mean, I'm so grateful to Constantine, who it really is the one who introduced me to. Even to you, really indirectly, except Diego was the direct, connection there. But I wouldn't have met all these people, Kate Deering and, everybody, Jessica Ash and Emma Skourakis and Danny Roddy, This is really a community of, I think of it more of a philosophy and like a think tank more than I do like a cult of HIIT trainers or a cult of like keto people or carnivore people or fruitarians or whatever you want to call it. Like it's definitely a think tank too, because with you guys, we collectively just sit around and go and talk about what's working for some people and maybe they need more carbs than the average person, or it's just so fascinating. And now with your neuroscience portion, I'm fascinated. I think it's just amazing. Tell me more about the neuroscience aspect of it all.
So the big thing that I think is important to remember with the neuroscience piece, because you can get lost in the neuroanatomy very quickly. You can get lost in a lot of very interesting, but not necessarily helpful ideas when it comes to neuroscience. I think the most important thing to realize is that everything you do interacts with your nervous system. From the food you eat to the sights you see, the sounds you hear, the things you smell, the taste you taste, all of that interacts with your nervous system. And depending on your brain, you're either going to have a positive or negative response. So for one person, they might not do well with that CrossFit workout, like we said. For another person, their therapy, their pain relief, their ability to improve their flexibility might be something as simple as a back rub. So it might be that when it comes to finding those little pieces that people are looking for to get them to that next point, to get them to feel that much better, to get out of that hole that much further, that you now need to incorporate some of those pieces neurologically to say, you know what, maybe I do need to change my environment. I need to get different light in my life. I need to get a different sound in my life. I'm always hearing traffic noises because I live in New York or something like that. You might to actually get out of your current environment to give yourself a different neurological activation pattern. And that can be hugely therapeutic. And so that's one of those pieces with neuroscience that allows you the permission and the understanding to say, I might have a different response to this very unique situation than somebody would expect. Because everything I've had in my life, every food that I've eaten up to this point has shaped my body. I might need something different than somebody else. And something that might make you feel better, something weird, like, you know what? I really feel good when I come home and I play the piano. That's your therapy. Cool. Might not be mine, that's okay. But neurologically, there's something about that that gives your nervous system, that gives your metabolism a favorable change. And so if we understand that we have lots of tools at our disposal, we can extend our options for health beyond just supplement cabinet, beyond just, oh, well, this diet didn't work for me, I have to jump to the next diet. It might not be a nutrition or supplement problem. It might be an activation issue. It
Interesting.
might be something fundamental.
That's so interesting because I think that one of the things I started adding to my programs lately for people when they do a Dutch with me, the Dutch lab, is a whole section just on calming the body down and calming the system and ways to do that through. And this is because of Mike Fave, also his help with stacking herbs. And I have an herbalist background and I never ever learned that, you know. In fact, I was steered against it and away from it because herbs can be quite potent. So you have to be careful about what you stack. But we learned what you shouldn't and shouldn't stack. So I don't know why they really never talked about that at length. But anyway, and so I just am finding it for myself so beneficial. And so now I'm really sharing it as much as possible with people in regards to like, you know, you cannot keep living, and you just said this in so many words, you can't keep doing the same things and expecting a different outcome, particularly when it comes to calming your system, relaxing, like creating new neural pathways. If I come home, and this just happened to me, ever since I started working for Onas, it's like sun up to sundown, and even not sundown, sometimes it's just till bedtime. I'm non-stop, and it's been 2 years. And we live in this tiny house, and it's just like I'm doing healthy things, but they're just the same things over and over and over until finally I was like, okay, I'm stuck in some kind of weird like vortex, like rabbit hole, like rut. And so funny you mentioned the piano because I bought this for my husband for his birthday a few years ago, and neither one of us were really playing it much. And so when I was going through this rut, he's going through a rut too, and we both were like, you know what? Let's go ahead and recommit to this, and started to do things and stacking the herbs and preaching, you know, acting what doing what I preach, practicing what I preach. And I think it's been the most helpful thing because I'm not able to just go on a vacation to Tahiti. You know, I just can't go out and just throw money at this problem. So instead, I'm looking for ways to just do little things in my environment that switch it up. Go outside more. I'm trying to work outside. I might even go to this gym, this new gym. They have a lounge and work there on programs instead of working here in this house. And a lot of people are doing that, right? Because they're working from their home. It's like try to get out and switch your perspective because it just gets so, you just get stuck.
You get good at what you practice.
So let's go back to adrenaline if you don't mind. So we talked about that and someone mentioned it in the group today. So I had this amazing session with Dr. Tyler Panzner, who blew my mind in regards to finding my top variants and then creating a protocol based on my genetic mutations, like the top five. And one of them was that I don't break down adrenaline well. But some people just don't even have to have a variant for that, right? Some people just don't break down adrenaline. They don't do it well. But why is that? Is that to do with carbon dioxide or their, what is that to do with?
I think a lot of times when it comes to adrenaline and even cortisol production and, for lack of a better term, creating that dominant state, I think a lot of that is going to come back to A, the cell's ability to take in and utilize fuel. Because as the cell takes in fuel, It makes energy from it. It's then going to create byproducts of that that act as signaling molecules to nearby cells and tissues, saying we're doing our job or we're not. But simultaneously, I think it's also the brain's ability to tell the body what energy demands are at that time. So when we talk about the shift from glycolysis into oxidative phosphorylation, I'm going to get geeky with the biochem for a second.
Please do.
But when we think glycolysis in a pro-metabolic sense, that's not our ideal state to be producing energy in. Because A, we're going to make less ATP for the same molar unit of glucose as we would for oxidative phosphorylation. And B, we're going to make lactic acid as a byproduct, where then oxidative phosphorylation will make more ATP, more of the actual energy currency, and will make CO2 as the main byproduct. And CO2 has a lot of protective effect and helps perpetuate more and more oxidative phosphorylation. Whereas lactic acid can be a signaling molecule that says we're under stress, and it can interfere with a lot of other processes. So in that state, if the brain is telling the body to shift its resources towards glycolysis because it perceives you're under stress, I think that's a big issue for a lot of people when it comes to that preponderance of adrenaline, is that you're going to have this overarching interpretation of the world saying you're not safe because your brain is missing certain pieces of information that tell it it is safe. And that then creates that cellular drive to move in a certain direction.
Interesting. So, what if you went to the gym with like some diluted orange juice in a water bottle and just sipped on orange juice while you worked out? Is that weird?
It's maybe weird to some people. It's not weird to me. I think that's a fantastic idea because part of the process of telling your body that you're safe is telling your body and your cells and your brain are monitoring this all the time. Your brain is constantly looking at the amount of sugar in your bloodstream. In fact, sugar doesn't require insulin to cross the blood-brain barrier. So your brain can constantly sense what is going on in your system. But as your body is sensing all of these different situations that are at hand on a cellular level, a lack of sugar creates that sense of danger for the brain. It's not an on-off switch, it's more of a dimmer switch.
Okay.
And so it's going to increase the potential for, well, wait a minute, you're doing all this other stuff, and I'm not seeing this increase in fuel coming in to match the amount of output you're creating. Maybe we need to allocate resources a little different to make sure you can survive all these other stimuli and all these other actions you're trying to create. Whereas if you have this nice, slow, steady increase in blood sugar that's either matching or outpacing your workload, that will tell your body and your brain that resources are not scarce, that they are abundant and readily available, and that I don't need to be in this stress slash protective state.
And you won't go into that emergency phase. Is that right?
In essence, yes. No, where you can get a little tricky in the workout window is that certain types of training will be more glycolytically favorable, meaning that they will steer you towards glycolysis more readily.
Okay.
So there is a lot of interest in what is called anti-glycolytic training.
Oh, really?
And so what anti-glycolytic training consists of is, in essence, training protocols that are stopping just shy of hitting that what point of reaching glycolysis. So this is again a little bit more down that biochemical route, but you have three different energy systems: your creatine phosphate system, your glycolysis system, and your aerobic system slash oxidative phosphorylation. Your creatine phosphate is usually about 5 seconds worth of work or less. Once you expand beyond that 5 seconds, then and you're still lifting weights, you're still creating a lot of effort, you're going to start going into that glycolysis system. So a lot of people are now saying, well, let's steer our training towards either just before that or just after that with less intensity so we can stay in that more oxidative phosphorylation state. So certain types of sports, so I'm going to use CrossFit as an example because that's a fun one, easy one to pick on. A lot of their training is just so glycolytic in its programming that it actually helps you to stay in glycolysis for longer. And that's part of why you probably experienced the symptoms you did, because you actually detrained your ability to generate adequate energy. Because the lack
Bummer.
of pieces you were creating during your training was poisoning your mitochondria's ability to actually steer you back towards oxidative phosphorylation.
So what would the so then it must be the oxidative phosphorylation phase must be like kind of like the Katie Bloomfield concept of low, slow, heavy rep. I mean, heavy weights, low reps, taking time, taking space, not getting into any
Yeah.
kind of like.
As a general rule of thumb, yeah. Now, where it gets a little bit more interesting is, again, from an individual standpoint, it depends on the person.
Okay.
Depends on the person's health, depends on the person's history, and it depends on your brain. Because if all of this comes back to, say, I'm doing 5 push-ups, my brain's either going to say that's a lot of push-ups, or that's not that many push-ups at all. Or that's a lot of weight to move, or that's not that much at all. That's a lot of effort, a lot of danger, a lot of potential strain and stress. I'm going to put you into that safety energy metabolism right away to protect you. Or, oh, five, you got this, no problem. And read the newspaper while you do this.
Yeah. So what about, okay, so then if I'm working out and I want to build muscle, so I'm going to want to increase, like probably sometimes bring the muscle to fatigue in order to increase the muscle or get those micro tears that you want in order to build the muscle, of course, because you're eating adequate protein and whatever to do the building. But in that state of the tearing down while you're working out, getting to a point of fatigue, you're probably leaving the oxidative phosphorylation phase. Did I say that right?
You said it right. Yes and no. So when it comes to building muscle, there's still a lot of confusion as to what actually stimulates muscle growth in the research. And
Fair.
so three things that are concluded at this point. There's micro damage to tissue, so those slight amounts of damage to a muscle. There's neurometabolic, or I'm sorry, neuromechanical tension, which means that you're actually creating a contraction in the tissue. You can't just hit somebody with a hammer and expect them to grow big muscles. You actually
Right.
have the tension piece, not just the damage. And then the third piece is you actually need some of the metabolic signals of energy production in that muscle. Now, where it gets interesting is if I think of that as a Venn diagram with three different circles, I can emphasize any one or two or three of those different pieces. I can go after a lot of tension, but very low metabolic byproducts or very low damage. I can emphasize the damage with very little tension. This would be things like running. Not a lot of
Okay.
tension to run, but I'm actually creating a lot of wear and tear on the body and the tissue over time. But yeah, that's probably a big part of why you don't see a lot of really jacked runners.
Right.
But from a metabolic standpoint, you can emphasize a lot of those things, the byproducts of the muscle break or the muscle usage itself. And that's where it gets into, okay, well, I'm going to train to failure. I'm going to train the CrossFit stuff. Like, yeah, that's you're emphasizing a lot of that metabolic stress. That's going to signal the need for an adaptation. But the safest thing that you can do is the tension piece. You'll still have some degree of muscle breakdown, you'll still have some degree of metabolic signaling, but the tension piece is probably the safest from a pro-metabolic standpoint. And this actually puts us now into questions about things like isometric training. The isometric tension, you can actually generate a lot more force isometrically than you can moving a weight. Measure this with force plates. They had somebody do an isometric contraction with a stationary barbell. So to back up for any of the listeners that don't know what an isometric contraction is, isometric contraction is where the muscle will contract and the joint will not move. So imagine a bodybuilder on stage flexing his muscles, lots of tension, no weights at all. Okay. So you can actually create this environment in the gym with, say, a squat rack. You load up more weight than you could ever deadlift, never lift off that bar. You put 1,200 pounds on there for all I care. You won't move it, but you go up and you set yourself up for the deadlift as if you're going to. and you'll pull. The bar will not move, but your tension that you're creating will be enormous. And that right there is a huge amount of that tension side of that equation. And so you can actually start to program isometric training into that. When they measure underneath a force plate, putting plates underneath people's feet, when they do that, to see how hard you're pushing into the ground with your legs and pulling against that bar versus how much somebody can lift, it's usually quite a bit more isometric. But the problem with isometric training, and the reason people don't do it often, is because you can't really quantify it very easily. You don't know how much tension you're creating. So it's hard to say, well, I think I'm getting better. I think I'm
Yeah.
But it's one of those things you kind of have to have the trust and the faith in the function of that you're trying to create to say, I feel good. And that's a big thing I think that people miss is feeling a certain way. And we talked about how pro-metabolic people will feel differently and they will have a different interaction. When you feel different because of your training and it's a positive feel, to me, that's probably the most important thing you can go after.
That reminds me of OsteoStrong. Do you know OsteoStrong? Yeah, there I went to an OsteoStrong gym. I think I had the yes, it was a guy who was doing this, his name is John. I don't remember his last name, but he had this like system, this band, these band systems.
John Jacquish.
Yes, that's it. He was on my show a long time ago. And you know him or you know of him?
Yeah, and he sells a product called the X3, which is that band.
Yeah, I have it right here. My
I wonder.
husband uses it. It's pretty cool. And he sent me to OsteoStrong and introduced me to the people that ran the one over here. And I went, and they the same thing. You know, we lifted. They have these machines and the weights. Like, there's no way you're lifting anything. You're just sitting there and you're like doing it for a few seconds. And but I think they said something about it having. They did some studies, I think, with for osteopenia or some bone loss issue, and how it had like tremendous amount better than weightlifting. It had better results using the isometric training. Do you know about that?
Yeah, that's one of those aspects of bone health that is super, super important. And people oftentimes don't worry about bones until they're dealing with osteoporosis. But your bones, in and of themselves, are big drivers of immune function. Your B cells live in your bone marrow. So the
Really?
integrity of your bones, yeah, that's where the B part comes from. So you have B cells and T cells, and your T cells come from your thymus.
Oh, I thought you meant bees. I thought you meant bees, like B vitamins. Because I was like, wait, isn't that the gut? Okay, got it. B
Yeah.
cell.
Your B cells, they live in your bone marrow. So if you don't have healthy bones, your immune system will suffer. And your bones can actually have a huge amount of influence on sensory activation for your brain because your bones can actually sense vibration and torsion and load. And if your bones aren't healthy, that's going to be one of those signals that goes to your brain to say, you're not safe. So having osteoporosis can influence adrenaline and cortisol. Simply because
Wow.
your brain doesn't feel safe moving because how it absorbs and deals with load and force will be interpreted as unsafe.
Incredible.
So isometric work that can generate tension can strengthen those bones. And weight training can too, walking can too. Doesn't only be isometric stuff. All of it's great. It's just that's one more very important reason why people should, if they're not, they should find some form of working out or exercise that they enjoy. Because the benefits go beyond weight loss or cholesterol or blood pressure. It literally can shape your entire existence and personality. Because when you
Wow.
change your brain, you change who you are.
Amazing. Yeah, I mean, I can definitely, I've tried all my life, or I shouldn't try, that's a terrible word. I attempted many different types of workouts and movements and all these things, just never my thing. And that's how I looked at it. Like, I'm just not that kind of person, and I'm just lucky that I'm not really overweight. And that's how I just sat with it. And now I'm like, oh, wow, what a disservice I was doing to my bone health and everything. Because, you know, those neural pathways are formed of, and now I'm having to like, it's like learning to play the piano. It's like I'm learning all this how to recover, how to use a machine there, how to lift properly, all of it. And I'm glad I'm doing it because, I'm heading real quick on that menopause train. But it's never too late, really, is it?
It's never too late. And you hit a key point earlier talking about your breathing during your training. If that's creating a stress response that your brain is then now associating with exercise, with training, you may have struggled with enjoying training for a long time because of that. And
Perfectly, yeah.
that's one of those things where a lot of people have such an aversion to exercise. And it creates a reason like that that's holding them back from actually moving. But when you look at how the body's designed, we're meant to move,
Yeah.
meant to traverse the earth and enact our will on the world. And so
Yeah.
when you can't actually move safely or in a happy way, and your brain is telling you, stop moving, don't move, world's not safe, there's something missing there. And it could be a fuel piece, could be a nutrition piece, could be a supplement piece. It could be that the training you're doing isn't neurologically appropriate for you. All of those things are fixable.
Wow, that's so good. That's incredible. I mean, it's a good way to wrap this up as well, because I feel like it's a wonderful message. Because you think about like a lot of people who go to the gym who maybe like are overweight and who feel uncomfortable about their bodies, and they go to the gym and their body and they're in a stress state, and so their brain is telling them they're not in a safe place. So not only do they have this physical part of it where I feel insecure, but now there's something else that's saying it's not safe there. Of course, that's brilliant. That really makes so much sense. And working on that. So how do you work with people? Do you work with people?
I do work with people. I primarily work with people one-on-one, or I have a membership group where every week we meet live and I talk in depth about all of these different pieces.
Cool. Great. Well, I'll put all of that information in the show notes so that people can reach you. And this was such a really unexpected piece to the metabolic puzzle, that I'm learning. I was not expecting to get into the neuroscience, even though it says here neuro coaching. But it's such a beautiful part of it that I didn't even think I would learn or didn't know existed. So thank you for that, especially me with my TBI that I have, just that there's so much that I can still do. So thank you for all of that. Appreciate you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Kitty.
That was such an eye-opener. I hope you guys learned as much as I did. I did join this new gym that I am using to do my Kitty Bloomfield program, of which I'm like 28 days in. Yeah, like a full month in. And it's so much fun. Besides the week where I couldn't go because I was coughing and exhausted from coughing all night, not getting any sleep, like 3 hours of sleep a night. And I ended up just taking a break, just taking a week off, which you have to do sometimes. And my coach, Nissa, supported that choice. And then I went back to the gym and felt so much stronger. And I have to tell her that I have added in some of these isometric concepts, like just putting on a weight that you can't even, you would never lift in a million years, like on a leg press machine or shoulder press machine, and then just pretending like you're going to lift it and really just creating that tension in the muscles. And I feel like it's really helped my shoulder, which I have this like micro tears in my rotator cuff, because who doesn't? And I feel like it feels, I think it's feeling much stronger. There's not a lot of pain in it. And when I feel sore from lifting the next day, it's totally gone. So I think it's helping. And then there's this guy who I think you guys turned me on to, who's called Knees Over Toes Guy. I think that's literally his IG name, is Knees Over Toes Guy. And he teaches people how to rehabilitate their knees by doing things that you would think you should do the opposite. You know how you're always hearing from trainers,
make sure your knee doesn't pass your toes when you're squatting or whatever. Well, this guy is like, oh, no, no, no. You have to really put a lot of pressure in this particular direction on your knees, or else you can't heal a torn ACL. And so one of the things is walking backwards on the treadmill, like really, really slowly, but with a lot of tension to push the treadmill with your feet. That has been tremendous because it's also creating some tension there, isn't it? Just like that concept of the isometric training, although I don't know if that falls under isometric training since you are moving your legs. Anyway, I'm doing that and my knee does not feel injured at all. It does not hurt. It doesn't feel strange. I'm doing at least 10,000 steps. Well, no, between 7 and 10,000 steps a day, almost every day. And it feels so good. So guys, I'm telling you, there's so much to be said. And this is coming from a person who was never athletic and never, I would start working out and then I would stop. And I am just really enjoying it. My husband's coming with me and he's showing me the ropes. And of course, my coach Nissa, who's in Australia, she's coaching me as well. We meet once a week. The program, the 16-week accelerator program, is awesome. I, would you believe, I'm having issues with the food. Me, Healthy Gut Girl, wrote 3 books about food and gut health, and I'm having issues with the food. We'll have another podcast about that another day. Anyway, if you want to learn more about Brian and if you want to work with him or join his online weekly meetup, all his info is in the show notes and he would love to hear from you. Woo!